from a nightclub at the end of the world. This is Michael C. Rupert. Welcome back to another installment of the Lifeboat Hour. In a second, I'm going to give you news updates from our world news desk at CollapseNet, which is, as of today, now in 55 countries. There are now more than 720 entries in our free Lighthouse directory, and we're up to 13 regional blogs and counting. We've given away 10 barter memberships for people who have submitted really useful items for the directory, and we're just getting ready to offer a new line of barter memberships for those for whom $100 a year, 27 cents a day, and I get it totally is out of reach. That's true for a lot of people. That will offer free memberships to those willing to run a well-written regional blog describing how things are unfolding, either good or bad, in their part of the world. And we got 13 of those going now from all over the world. It's a cool thing. To all staff and volunteers who are making CollapseNet such a success and who are providing such dedicated service, deepest thanks, guys. You're doing just great. You can find out more about CollapseNet by going to www.collapsenet.com. Tonight's guest is my good friend Jimmy Baldoff, president of ASPO USA, or for those who don't know what that means, that's the Association for the Study of Peak Oil USA. Jim's going to join us from Austin, Texas here in a few minutes. Let me read just a quick statement that Jim issued at ASPO's, part of a statement that came out in a press release from ASPO's recent conference in Washington, D.C. Sorry, I turned away from the mic. He writes, "We are at the point of no return," stated Jim Baldoff, president of ASPO USA. "While global demand is accelerating worldwide, oil supplies have reached a plateau and are now in decline. The era of low-cost, easy-to-get oil has come to an end, a moment of historic significance and one fraught with danger. The Gulf of Mexico disaster occurred because the quest for new supplies requires that we drill miles beneath the ocean surface. Without affordable energy to drive our economy, we can expect price spikes and economic crisis to be the new normal. The debate about peak oil is over. It is time for bold action. If we do not change our current approach, we will see tremendous global repercussions." We'll have Jim on in a few minutes. If you want to ask Jim a question tonight, you can call toll-free to 1-888-874-4888, or you can send me an email that will reach me directly at lifeboathour@collapsenet.com. That's lifeboathour@collapsenet.com. That'll come right to me if you got a question you'd like me to ask Jim on the air. And again, 888-874-4888. Okay, let's do a little news. As I was just talking to Gary Null in the show right before this one at the end of it, thanks for having me on, Gary. Currency wars are in full swing right now, and what's happening is that the Japanese yen has risen to a level, it's becoming stronger, that it hasn't been at for probably since the end of the Second World War. It's well below 82 yen to the dollar. It's now down, the last I checked was a 78 or 79, which means that Japanese export goods like Toyotas, Nissans, Sonys, I mean, you can make the list long, are not being bought because they're becoming more expensive, and the Japanese economy is tanking. In the meantime, currency fluctuations are taking place all over the world, and meetings of the G7, G20 have been really unsuccessful in trying to put a Band-Aid on this bleeding wound. So currency wars are going to continue, and the U.S. government, Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, and Tim Geithner really want to weaken the U.S. dollar, which is not going to help you at all. Their theory is that it'll spur manufacturing here, and it already has been priced into the stock market. That's what the recent gains are. But everything now is kind of impinging on an event that events are narrowing down, called quantitative easing 2, where the Federal Reserve is going to start buying treasuries with the intent of driving interest rates below zero. Figure that one out. Where they already are, and it's what Japan's tried for the last decade, and it hasn't worked. Japan just seems to be helpless now, and is getting absorbed, if you will, into the greater Chinese economic sphere of influence, and that's not going to be preventable. So there's a lot of stuff going on, but all the storm clouds are clear and present. We're starting to see dates certain in through November, when a number of events are going to happen. We're documenting that for you on a daily basis on the World News Desk at CollapseNet, where we bring you the best compilation, daily digest of stories from around the world. So we're in a really tough place, guys. And this is like the part on the stage when the drummer is just giving the drum roll blah, 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 before the cymbal hits and everything kind of comes due. And I'm not the only one who's been saying this. Of course, I have a decent record of calling things. But headlines are screaming it all over the world. And the Federal Reserve looks to go bankrupt, and plus Mortgagegate now has basically made it impossible for anybody to value a house, and it's not going away. Even though somebody tried to introduce a bill recently that would allow all the criminal activity of the banks, you know, like robo-signing and making things up and forging people's names and not securitizing loans, to be legal. That's not going to float well with the American people. And we're seeing some very strong signs now. We have major people, any major dude will tell you, like Ron Paul, you know, we're standing at the brink of another revolution as all this stuff hits home, plus 2 more million people lose all of their unemployment benefits end of November. So, woohoo, here we go. So, that's where we sit in the world, and we have to stay cheery about this stuff, and we're going to play a New White Trash song from my band, New White Trash, in a few minutes. But I think right now I'd like to go to Austin, Texas, and ask my friend Jimmy Baldoff how he's doing. How are you, Jim?
Mike, thank you. I'm doing just fine.
All right. So the ASPO USA conference was in Washington, what, 2 weeks ago?
Right.
And you had some heavyweights. Who'd you have come to speak?
We had former Secretary of Defense and Secretary of Energy and CIA Director, Dr. James Schlesinger. We had Mr. Jeff Rubin, former chief economist, CIBC in Canada. We had Dr. Robert Hirsch, who authored the famous Hirsch Report for the Department of Energy.
Met him several times.
We also had Ralph Nader and Bianca Jagger.
Bianca Jagger? What?
Bianca Jagger.
Okay, what did she have to say?
Well, she was coming to Washington. She called up. She was going to come to the conference, and we said, "Well, while you're here, why don't you say a few words?" So she did. She's very concerned about climate change and human rights issues around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Global warming and climate change and peak oil are the evil twins joined at the hip, we say.
Yeah. You and I have known each other for a few years, and we've kind of banged into each other at conferences all over the country. And, of course, I've done a few international ASPOs, too, Paris, Berlin, and other stuff in Edinburgh, Scotland. But I know that privately you and I have shared a lot of frustration about how mainstream media lied, I don't know what any other word to use, and how the government lied when we were aware from looking at the technical stuff, listening to folks like Matt Simmons, a great friend of ours who I'm sure we both miss. We saw that also that governments were aware, were acting as if they were aware. And I got kind of frustrated with ASPO USA in 08. That's the last one I went to, and that's where I saw Matt Simmons last time. And I just said somebody ought to start the Association for the Response to Peak Oil, because I didn't see a lot of real awareness there. It was kind of treated lightly. Is there a change? I mean, was ASPO this year different? Was it better? Would I have liked it?
Absolutely. We, you know, we're a young organization. We're just 6 years old. And for the first 3 or 4 years, we very deliberately focused just on the metrics of watching oil peak and decline worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
That was a handful right there.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to get our technical credibility down by actually being able to measure the flows. The United States, for instance, as you know, peaked in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, in the last 150 years, we produced extracted, actually. We don't produce. We extract oil. Extract more and more and more. And any finite resource is going to have a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Mm-hmm.
So the United States peaked in its oil extraction / production in the year 1970, and it has been downhill ever since.
And am I not correct that Ken DeFazio was pretty much right when he said that global oil production would peak in November 2005?
Well, pretty much. People now concede that conventional light sweet crude oil peaked between 2005 and 2008. Mike, whenever you start talking about resource constraints, particularly in terms of energy, people always respond by saying, well, what about all these big new fields I hear about off the coast of Brazil?
I'd love that.
Or what about up in the Arctic, Jim? Up in the Arctic, we can drill if the environmentalists would just get out of the way. That's another
Jim, that's another response. Your timing is beautiful, baby. I'm holding a story in my hands here from the Associated Press this week. It's datelined in Anchorage, Alaska, that says that, quote, federal scientists say the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska, which is ANWR as you and I know it, contains less than one-tenth of the amount of oil they previously estimated. The U.S. Geological Survey says new data puts the new estimation at 896 million barrels of oil compared with the agency's 2002 mean estimate of 10.6 billion barrels. I know what I want to do when I hear that. Jim, what, talk about it.
Well, absolutely. And you have to understand there are strong lobbying forces that say drill, baby, drill. Now, most laymen would be surprised to learn that those are not necessarily the major oil companies. They're the drilling contractors. The drilling contractors make their money by drilling holes. They don't even care if there's oil there.
That's right.
They get paid to drill the hole. Major oil companies are not lined up, straining at the bit to drill in ANWR or anywhere else. They know the reality
mm-hmm.
of
now
oil reserves.
You're an old oil man, right? Tell us about your background.
Well, I have kind of a schizophrenic background. I'm an environmental advocate, a grassroots environmentalist here in Texas. And also, about 20 years ago, kind of by accident, I got in the oil business. And our little company here in Austin, we drill wells primarily in Central Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And we go down vertically, and then we kick out horizontally, maybe 3,000 or 4,000 feet, into certain formations. And in so doing, we intersect fracture systems throughout that 3,000 or 4,000 foot wellbore that we drill horizontally.
Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid to say that I have watched peak oil play out under my own drill bit.
Wow.
We've been in business for about 23 years. We're still finding oil. We still have a profitable business, but we're having to drill twice as deep at twice the cost.
Mm-hmm.
To get about half the production.
I remember when I first met Colin Campbell, which would have been, I think, in Paris in 2003 at the ASPO International Conference there. And he made it very clear. Now, it might have been before that when I talked to him on the phone, but he made it very clear that the moment it costs more money to obtain a barrel of oil than you can get for selling it, you leave the oil parked in the ground. Is that right?
Well, not quite, but, I mean, in principle, he's right. You certainly don't take it out of the ground to use it for energy. Now, you might pay more than what a barrel of oil is worth, in standard terms, to get it out and use it for those things that only oil can be used for, i.e. for downstream petrochemical products.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then you're not getting the oil as an energy and using it as an energy source. You're using it as a raw material, a scarce raw material, to produce other items.
And oil is in everything, like all plastics are made from oil.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. People, it's kind of commonplace to say, well, yeah, everybody knows our society runs on oil. But they really don't know the extent of it. For example, let's just take agriculture. Now, back when we were kids growing up, we had family farms all over this country. And they had a process called three-crop rotation.
Mm-hmm.
In the fall, they would plant certain crops, and those crops would take certain nutrients out of the ground and put others back in. And then in the spring, they'd have the second crop, and that would replace certain nutrients that were taken out. And then in the summer, they'd have the third crop. Well, we don't have family farms and three-crop rotation anymore. We have factory farms. We have corporate farms. And we have, instead of three-crop rotation on thousands of family farms, we have maybe 10,000 acres in Central California that is planted in strawberries, let's say.
Genetically modified. We're going to be we are coming up here on our time for the new white trash song for tonight. And I got to tell you, I've been going to ASPO conferences internationally and around the country, and I've seen government people there, and you know, it just kind of triggered just a lot of old sensations. So New White Trash, which is my band, has a song. It's our spy song. It's called Train to Paris. Here it is. Train to Paris from New White Trash. You can find us at www.newwhitetrash.com. That was a fun song to write and record. That was me singing Perfect Passport Smile and all that stuff. But I really like doing a beer in the beer garden. Faites bonjour, mesdames et messieurs. I like to do accents. It's kind of a way to escape the madness. But the propaganda angle kind of fit real perfectly there. If you want to find out about New White Trash and you want to hear that song, go to the website, newwhitetrash.com. You can find there our new CD, a double CD with 37 originals called Double Wide. And you can download them for $12.12. And we're just about to announce, I think we already have, that we have the physical CDs now ready to ship. And we have a sponsor's edition there that includes a really cool hand-assembled book. And we'll make you a producer on our next project. Also available at the site, but go check us out at newwhitetrash.com. I just had to do the spy stuff, Jim. You know, it's because
great
there is...
music, Mike. Great music.
Thank
Let me
you.
Finish my agriculture story.
Go ahead, and then right after that we got a caller, but go ahead.
Okay, we have 10,000 acres planted, let's say, in strawberries in Central California. Now, because we don't have three crop rotation, replenishing soils, etc., we have 10,000 acres of totally barren, useless soil.
Mm-hmm.
These strawberries have now for decades been grown just on fertilizer.
Yep.
And that comes from natural gas.
Yep.
Now, because we don't have three crop rotation as family farms did, which used to confuse the bugs and the weeds, now we have 10,000 acres of strawberries, so all the strawberry bugs have reached out to their relatives across the nation and said, come on over. It's strawberry heaven. So they have moved in force, and so have the weeds that thrive on strawberries. So now we have to spray that 10,000 acres with hundreds of millions of gallons of pesticides and herbicides.
And we know
and
where those come
from. Oil.
Yep.
Now, we haven't even gotten around to picking it yet. Believe me, that involves oil. And then as soon as it's picked, it's shrink-wrapped in plastic, and of course, that comes from oil.
Yep.
Then the shrink-wrapped packages are hauled to San Francisco or L.A. or someplace, and they're refrigerated, and then they're put on refrigerated 18-wheel trucks, and they're hauled clean across the country to New York so that people can have strawberries on their Belgian waffles.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get me wrong. I like strawberries on my Belgian waffles. But we're going to have to start growing our strawberries close to home. This is unsustainable. And this is the extent to which our society is totally addicted to oil.
Yeah,
and most people don't recognize it.
And we may talk about entitlement later on the show. Are you ready for a caller, Jim?
Sure.
All right. We got Jason in Alberta, Canada, who emailed and called, too. He's been holding. Jason, are you there?
Yeah. How you doing, guys?
All right, man. How are you?
Hi, Jason.
Good, thanks.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think there are more frankenberries than strawberries. They're probably GMO.
Yeah.
I have a well testing company up here in Alberta, and funny enough, designing it so that it's foolproof has actually cost us work, and that's because we can't cook the books. So, I wonder if I have a job there Monday, but so when it comes time to test them, some of them don't show any production.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the practices is to put a number in, even knowing it was not found. So I had an idea of creating an oil company of having plastic wellheads everywhere. I'll just say they'd produced half a deck each. So there's that, and there's like there's a ton of these facilities around here that, you know, they make like 30 barrels a day, and yet they cost, you know, I don't know how much to maintain. They're just huge behemoths. So, wow, are we ever in trouble anyways?
Absolutely.
So how do you think the rest of the oil-producing industry is for those types of practices?
Let's look at the recently ballyhooed shale plays. Mm. We have the Barnett Shale in North Texas, the Marcellus Shale, several other shale formations, in which industry is going down, drilling horizontally into a shale formation, and then fracking it using...
Oh, yeah, I used to work on a service rig and all about that.
Okay.
One of the old companies that worked for it, horizontal.
Right, and then they frack the hell out of them. Now, the first thing that you should... of course, the layman wouldn't understand, but shale is traditionally source rock. That's where oil is cooked, in shale. And it takes hundreds of millions of years to do that. And then the oil in the shale migrates out of the shale and goes up towards the surface and then gets trapped in various cap rock situations and then fills reservoirs, geologically formed reservoirs, with oil. Now, that's a typical oil reservoir. And then you drill down into this reservoir where the oil has migrated out of the shale, and you pump out liquid oil. But what these shale plays are is trying to short-circuit 100 million years of geology by going straight to the source rock. And before the oil migrates out and gets trapped in a reservoir, we're fracking it. Industry is trying to frack it straight out of the shale, out of the source rock. Now, there's been a lot of publicity about these shale plays, and many people say, ah, yes, that's what's going to save us. But
Asia's buying into it pretty hard.
I beg your pardon?
Asia's buying into it pretty hard.
Well, a lot of people are buying into it.
There's no place else to go.
But if you really crunch the numbers on it, look at Chesapeake. If you really crunch the numbers on it, it doesn't look very good. And they have to keep drilling to keep the numbers going.
I was just reading an article on CollapseNet about exponential versus hyperbolic decline curves, and there's a huge argument on right now.
That's right. Now, if you'd like to know more about this specific subject, please go to ASPO USA's website, and it's real easy, aspousa.org, and look for the presentation given by Mr. Arthur Berman, Art Berman, at our conference just ended 2 weeks ago in Washington, D.C. Art Berman and others, Mr. Henry Groppi in Houston, and others have really crunched the numbers on these shale plays, and it looks like they're going to be net energy losers.
Yeah, Matt Simmons was saying that. Guys, we're coming up on a station break, so this is one of those got-to-do things at the bottom of the hour. Our guest tonight is Jim Baldoff, president of ASPO USA, an oil man, environmental activist, great guy, good friend. If you'd like to ask Jim a question about Energy Peak Oil, please call us at 1-888-874-4888, or you can email me, Mike Rupert, directly at lifeboathour@collapsenet.com, and I'll get your questions here and read them on the air. But we're going to take a little break here. Be back in a minute.
Listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Freedom News Hour will bring you up to date on the latest news on the financial meltdown.
Begin restoring local communities. It can happen.
We'll be exploring the issues from a freedom-oriented, small government perspective.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Melinda Pillsbury-Foster.
I am Jake Towne.
Join us live Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Hi, I'm Eric Davis, host of Expanding Mind. Join me and co-host Maja Daou each week as we explore the culture of consciousness, spirituality, neuroscience, media tech, and all manner of wonders and esoterica. Expanding Mind streams every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your mind open.
Hello, I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and you can hear my program, If You Love This Planet, right here on the Progressive Radio Network, every Sunday at 3 p.m. Please join me as I interview a huge variety of special guests from around the world about a range of topics, including the health of the planet and prescriptions for survival. So, if you do love this planet, tune in to the Progressive Radio Network every Sunday at 3 p.m.
What will be the impact of the Tea Party on the upcoming midterm elections? Who are these Tea Partiers? Are they really only a bunch of right-wing rednecks? Listen in every Thursday night from 7 until 8 Eastern to A More Perfect Union as your host, Bill Thompson, gets the inside stories from actual Tea Party players. Call in with your comments and questions, challenge guests, or show support. A More Perfect Union, Thursday nights, 7 until 8, only on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Lifeboat Hour with Michael C. Rupert. My guest tonight is Jim Baldoff, president of ASPO USA. We got a caller on the line. I just got to tell you real quick, by the way, that song you were just heard a piece of, a taste of there, is called We Can't Escape From. It's the first song I co-wrote with the band, and I sing some of the choruses on that, and that's a great song. It just really gets to you. For next week's show, guys, I'll be up in Sonoma County, actually for the next two shows, in Northern California. But for next week, I'm going to do something that I think really needs to be done. I'm going to do an entire show on firearms. I get questions all the time. You know, I'm scared. Should I buy a gun? If I do, what kind of gun should I buy? What do I do? And I am very qualified to talk about that. Not only was I a cop with LAPD, I was in two in-policy shootings, and then I was on staff at the police academy where I evaluated LAPD's training, firearms among that. Then I was among the million day jobs that I've had in the course of my lifetime. I was a manager at the largest gun store in the state of California for a few years. We sold to police departments and government agencies as well as civilians, and I got to shoot pretty much everything. And then I've been privileged and blessed to make a lot of friends among guys from U.S. Army Special Forces. I call them green beanies, and lately I've made some good friends who are retired Navy SEALs. So I've been around guns for 40 years, and that's what we're going to talk about next week. So if you got questions, you can email us in advance at lifeboathour@collapsenet.com. We'll get those questions and read them. Bring all your questions to the show next week, and I'll be doing that to you with you from Northern California. Okay, it looks like we lost Jason. Jim, you're still there, right?
I am.
Good. You know, listen, I got to tip my hat to Jason because what I just heard from him was he showed some real courage to say some things that that might have been sensitive for him, and I truly appreciate that, and I want to thank Jason for calling in and sharing that with us. Jim, the books are cooked everywhere. We've known that for a long time. But we're also seeing books cooked in Mortgagegate like you can't believe, of course, like I was warning about back since 04 and 05. But I think all the books are pretty much cooked anywhere. Can we trust any information that we get about reserves and who's got what now?
Well, there's reserves, and then there's reserves. And for instance, most of the OPEC countries, or at least Saudi Arabia certainly doesn't make its reserves known. The United States' most publicly traded oil companies have reserves. But let me tell you something about reserves. If you go to a reserve auditor or certifier analyst, they will present a document that will certify and audit the reserves, but it's all based on information provided by the company.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this huge disclaimer at the beginning of the report that says, this is based on data of proven and probable reserves provided by the company. And from this data, we can certify and audit and certify that there are X amount of reserves. Mm-hmm. But the raw, you know, the input comes from the company. And the old computer slogan may apply, garbage in, garbage out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that all oil companies provide faulty reserve data, but I'm saying we really don't know. You know, what our friend Matt Simmons, the late Matt Simmons, who passed away very suddenly, what he used to say is, I don't care about the reserves that people claim are beneath the ground.
Mm-hmm.
I want to have, he said famously, I want to have field-by-field production confessions.
Mm.
In other words, not the reserves under the ground. Show me what is being produced and at what rate.
I was a little distracted because I was thinking about Matt too, as you were talking about that. There are terms that occur in accounting that are like ultimately recoverable reserves, estimated reserves, probable reserves, proven reserves, and they all kind of mean different things.
That's right.
How do you keep? I have long had the belief that President Cheney's National Energy Policy Development Group in 2001, as a matter of fact, I produced evidence of that in my book, Crossing the Rubicon, and I discussed that again in my new book, Confronting Collapse, from Chelsea Green. I think they absolutely knew what was going on. I believe that there are some parts of government that have been aware of peak oil for a long time. What do you think about that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's not, people refer to the peak oil theory. Peak oil is a theory the way gravity is a theory.
Yeah, exactly.
You might come up with some intellectual construct that says gravity doesn't really exist, but would you step off the cliff? Of course not. Similarly, some people may come up with some kind of a theoretical construct that says that the second law of thermodynamics doesn't exist, that oil really is not a finite resource. In fact, there's even this one wacky theory called abiotic oil theory, which says it's cooked in the center of the earth somehow. But we know how oil was formed. Geology is a very mature science. All the big oil fields have been discovered. The low-hanging fruit has been picked. We are now having to drill 3 miles down in the Gulf of Mexico to find oil. We are having to frack oil out of shale rock, which is source rock. Trust me, if there was oil, easy to get conventional oil, we wouldn't be drilling in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico 3 miles down.
Mm-hmm.
If we drill a dry hole here in central Texas, it's a $3 or $4 million dry hole, and that's terrible. But if you drill a dry hole in the Gulf of Mexico 3 miles down, it's a $500 million dry hole.
Yeah, I was remembering when they were touting that there was like 300 billion barrels in the Caspian Basin.
Right.
And the world uses a billion barrels every 11, 12 days. And those estimates are now whittled down to maybe 40 billion barrels.
Exactly.
But I think four of the first five wells or something like that were all dry holes in the Caspian Basin at like, 100, 200 million apiece?
Well, it's interesting because, certain Western interests really displayed an interest in, say, Afghanistan, when the Caspian Basin was deemed to be hot.
Right.
And as those reserves dwindled from, say, 200 million down to 50 or 40 million barrels, the interest has sort of waned. Or you'll have people say, well, I read just in the paper the other day about a huge new find off the coast of Brazil. Maybe 6 billion barrels.
Carioca.
Well, now, 6 billion barrels sounds like a whole lot, Mike, until you realize that the world consumes over 80 million barrels of crude oil a day.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States consumes over 20 million barrels of crude oil a day here in the United States. We represent about 6% of the world's population, but we consume 25% of the world's oil.
In my book, Confronting Collapse, I wrote about the Carioca field in Brazil, which was drilled, and the headlines came out, you know, estimated 6-10 billion barrels of oil, and that was on the basis of having drilled only one well. Now, my understanding, and of course, these estimates, after they drove the stock market up, you know, 20, 30 points, and
right,
the price of oil down, there was a little correction saying, oh, there's nowhere near that much oil because they hadn't drilled any appraisal wells. And appraisal wells are, once you strike oil in one place, don't you have to drill some wells around it to find out how far the field might go? How does that work?
That's right. You have to, delineate the boundaries of the field. But you don't have to go to Brazil. Look again in the Gulf of Mexico. There was a field brought in with a big offshore platform that developed multiple wells not too many years ago called Thunder Horse,
mm-hmm,
another BP project, mm-hmm, interestingly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Thunder Horse field and the wells and the platform that was extracting oil from those fields, they were ballyhooed at one point as being our salvation. Well, turns out they peaked and began a decline about 6-8 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And when these things decline, as you know, Mike, they decline and there is no return forever after. They go down because there's a beginning, a middle, and an end to any finite resource. Each well is a finite body of oil to that well.
Mm-hmm.
Each field has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Each country has a beginning, a middle, and an end. As we know, the U.S. peaked and began its decline in the 1970s. Every other country now has reached its peak and is declining, with the possible exception of Saudi Arabia, although Matt Simmons
don't start me, man. Go ahead.
Thinks and wrote that they're probably in decline. About the only country that can safely be said not to have reached its peak, not to be about to decline, what country do you think that is? Iraq.
Probably Iraq, yeah, of course.
And that's because they've been bombed back to the Stone Age for the last 10 or 15 years.
Sure.
And they literally haven't been able to develop their reserves.
Iraqi production peaked at 3.5 million barrels a day just before Gulf War I, which was interrupted. That doesn't mean that they had passed their peak. That's just what their production was. But they've come nowhere near that figure since. And so that's, of course, why we went to Iraq. And, of course, I wrote about that in Confronting Collapse, too, and that's been admitted.
Oh, you don't think it was the weapons of mass destruction, Mike?
I think they're probably the same place as all the real clear titles are to people's houses that are being foreclosed at, like, 25,000 a day around the country right now. So,
you know, the interesting thing about the Bush-Cheney regime, they went over there, and they were such bunglers, they couldn't even steal the oil right, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They just made the whole country so angry that U.S. companies now aren't even getting in on the production contracts.
Well, you know, The only thing I can think of now to say has expletives in it, so I'm not going to say anything. But we have an email from Jacob. Looks like he's in Wichita. You might know something about this, Jim. He says, I'm a follower of Lifeboat Stuff. Thanks. There are lies about reserves in Oklahoma. He mentions a company called Koch and Hirschberger here in Wichita that lied about what they had in a fight with Indians about what's there, probably on reservations. He's asking, how can we believe anything? I hear a lot of anecdotal stories like this. Do you know anything about this particular situation?
No, I don't. But, all the excesses that we can imagine are usually just amplified when it gets to Native American ancestral lands.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these are under the jurisdiction of the federal government. I guess all of them are, or under tribal control. And some of the tribal councils are friendly with oil companies, and others are not. I don't know anything about the specific example that the gentleman cites, but I know that, reserves under the ground are just very, very speculative kind of thing.
If you'd like to ask Jim Baldoff, president of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil USA, a question, the number is 1-888-874-4888, or you can email me directly, I can say that, at lifeboathour@collapsenet.com. This is Michael C. Rupert. Okay, so let's go to something else that I know. Well, we know where I stand on this, and we certainly knew where Matt Simmons stood on this. Let's talk about Deepwater Horizon, Macondo, the Gulf, and what's happened there. Can you give us your assessment of that, Jim?
Well, it's just a real tragedy. 11 people lost their lives. The ecosystem, the wetlands, the marshlands have been damaged greatly. Those wetlands may or may not clean up some of the mess that was left there. Now, some people say that there is natural seepage of oil in the Gulf of Mexico and in other bodies of water that are above naturally occurring oil reservoirs. And it's true, there is natural seepage. There is occasionally oil or gas leaking up from natural fissures in the ocean floor and leading into the water. That's true. But I guarantee you, the millions of barrels, gallons total, that the Macondo well put into that ecosystem was not natural seepage. And it should not be regarded as natural seepage.
Do you accept or believe BP's assertions and the assertions of the United States government that, 80% of the oil has been recovered and that there's no danger down there and that the Corexit solved the problem and that some new species of bacteria, as reported in the New York Times, evolved to eat the oil? Do you believe all that?
Mike, I don't pretend to be an ocean scientist,
mm-hmm.
an oceanographer, or even an oil scientist. I'm a simple oil man down here in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
We drill wells. But all I know is that if you put that much accidental oil in a body of water,
mm-hmm.
that's already getting natural seepage, let us say, and is accommodating that as part of the natural ecosystem remediation processes, it just doesn't seem to me that that oil is going to just disappear. Now, this is just my opinion,
mm-hmm.
because I'm not an ocean scientist.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the media reports were wrong. I certainly, we all know that some of the BP reporting was wrong, and I'm not really sure what's right. But I can tell you this, as more and more reports come out, it looks like BP and Halliburton that did the cement job,
right,
that failed on this well, were both, according to the government reports, commissions that are studying the issue, at least BP and Halliburton had major flaws in their work on that well. Now, there could be others. The blowout preventer itself, made by Cameron Ironworks. We don't know if that blowout preventer, it may be that the blowout preventer did just fine, and that flaws in the rest of the well engineering caused it to malfunction. We just don't know.
Right,
but I am very, very slow to say that, hey, everything is fine now.
You know, one of the things that I'm perceiving, Jacob just emailed back, he was referring to Koch Industries in Wichita.
Oh, Koch Industries, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, which is a pretty big outfit. I just thought I would correct that.
Well, they're really a piece of work, yeah.
What one of the things that I'm concerned about is that it was very clear that there was enormous pressure on BP to bring deep water in, to bring the well in and get it online. There was a lot of cost cutting. There were so many corners cut, it was a circle by the time it blew up. And I see the cost pressures and also the major stresses on just our engineering technology, because we're able to drill maybe that far out, but I don't think from an engineering standpoint the oil industry is able to put in safeguards like they are in 200-300 feet of water. Are you optimistic, Jim, that as a result of Deepwater Horizon, you're going to have the best quality engineering in, investments made to prevent something like this again? Do you think that that sledgehammer hit anybody in the head?
Well, I think so, because, you know, let's say, and I'm not sure this is the case, but let's say that BP cut some corners to hasten the drilling and completion of the well, say, by 2 or 3 weeks, which would have cost, let's say, maybe $200,000 a day.
Mm-hmm.
Believe me, that was being penny-wise and pound-foolish, wasn't it?
Indeed. But did anybody learn any lessons from that, do you think?
Well, I think so. I think that companies are now acutely aware that they really better pay attention, or they could have, you know, a $50 billion dry hole. I mean, it's sort of a double whammy. Number one, it appears that that would have been a hell of a well.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have, you know, it could have made BP a bunch of money. But no more. Another thing that needs to be considered is an industry-wide or a national response to worst-case scenario disasters. For instance, in the North Sea, there was a rig called the Piper Alpha, I believe it was, that blew up 30 years or so ago. It killed 170 people. As a result of that, all the countries surrounding the North Sea,
mm-hmm.
Scandinavian countries, England, Ireland, Scotland, Norway, Denmark, all the countries that were involved in exploring and producing out of the North Sea came up with a collective response system whereby they pooled their money. That way each company or each country wouldn't have to buy a fleet of skimming ships, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And so they centrally planned and came up with a good worst-case scenario disaster response system. Something that clearly we did not have.
Yes. So you think that that's going to be, so that's encouraging, because on the World News Desk at CollapseNet, I think it was about a week, 10 days ago, we had a story up out of somewhere. It might have been IEA, but it was saying that 60 to 70% of all new drilling in the world from this point on is going to be deep water. That just really scared me.
Well, I don't know if that's the case. You know, deep water drilling is not a bargain for major oil companies. I mean, you know, you don't have to have an explosion and a disaster. You just have to have a few dry holes. And all of a sudden, it becomes, you know, I mean, it's just orders of magnitude different. Mm-hmm. In East Texas, back in the good old days, you could punch a hole in the ground practically and have an oil well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just think what we're having to do these days to extract oil.
Well, okay, Jim, we're down. Jim Baldoff, president of ASPO, Association for the Study of Peak Oil USA. We're down to our last couple of minutes here. What's in store for ASPO? What are you guys up to, and what are you going to be doing?
Well, we are growing. The energy issue is more and more important, critically important. Energy is the root of everything. It's the mother of all commodities. You don't grow soybeans or pork bellies or mine gold without oil.
That's right.
So we think that ASPO, as the go-to group for the study and public education surrounding peak and decline of crude oil production and other energy sources worldwide, is an organization that is going to be needed more as time goes on.
We're running right out of time, Jim. We're down to our last few seconds. What I'm hoping to see is ASPO taking a bigger hand in talking about the response to peak oil.
Absolutely. And, We're becoming a much more solution-oriented group now.
Okay. Well, Jim Baldoff, president of ASPO USA, old friend, thank you for being with us tonight on the Lifeboat Hour. I wish you good luck and say hi to all my friends at ASPO. That's all the time we have for tonight here on the Lifeboat Hour. Next week we'll be talking about firearms. Bring all your questions about what you want to know, what you might think about. You can email us at lifeboathourcollapsenet.com during the week with your questions, but we'll be back next week. I'll be talking to you from Northern California with another segment of the Lifeboat Hour. Good night.